Welcome, everyone, to an all-new installment of the Big League Stew Podcast, the Stew Pod, as we call it. I am Mike Oz.
And I am Chris Swick.
Chris, how is it going this week?
Pretty good, trying to ease into the holiday week.
Yeah, man, the holidays just screw you up on everything. And
it throws everything off.
It does. But I will say I was very happy with the first week of the podcast, so I want to thank everybody who listened. I know I was texting Chris, like, over the weekend, like, hey, man, look how many people listen to our podcast. And we had quite a few people, thousands and thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands, way more than we thought. So thank you, guys. That was really awesome. Hope you enjoy what you're hearing. And I think we have a really good episode this week. Chris, would you like to tell the people what some of what they can expect?
Sure. So with the first All-Star Balloting updates coming out, we're going to take a look at some of the things that we like from those, some of the things we don't like. We have to talk about the Marlins because they just seem to be in the news every week now. You know, some stuff coming out of Philadelphia that we're going to talk about.
And drama in Philly? No, never.
Yeah, and then we're going to talk about one of the hottest teams in baseball, and I'm not going to say what they are now.
Ooh, so that's a tease.
Yeah, that's a tease. Why the people are excited. They're going to listen just to hear what team I tease there.
And we mentioned it last show, and we kind of bearing the lead here. We have Evan Longoria joining us on the show this week to talk about the Rays, who also are our surprise team so far, and his new shoe coming out. So we're going to talk about sneakers and whatnot with Evan Longoria. And something new we're doing this week, we're going to answer a reader email in earnest, actually, too, not like in a we're making fun of it kind of way. Like, we're going to actually answer somebody's questions. So that's what we got going on. Thank you guys for joining us again on Stew Pod. Let's jump right into this All-Star voting thing because it's funny, you know, Chris, we write about a lot of stuff, and to me All-Star voting is rather benign in the sense that I think we all know that it's kind of like a popularity contest. It's a fan thing. You know, people stuff the ballots, especially like this early in the whole thing. Like, a lot of people aren't even really caring yet. They start to care sort of after the, you know, the results kind of come out. But even when the first results came out, people were just, like, super offended, you know, that so-and-so is leading the vote. And, like, it's not even that the person is an all-star. It's just that, you know, in the first of, like, 10 ballots updates, like, they're number one. So people super care about all-star voting, I guess. So I thought it would be fun if we talked about some things we love and some things we hate from the all-star results so far. I guess just to give people a little bit of the news here, if you haven't been paying attention. The Royals, like, dominated the first update on the AL side. They had, I think, like, five starters, and the Cardinals were pretty much in the same position on the NL. So in Missouri, they must teach you how to really, really work online voting. Chris, I'll start with you. What's one thing you loved about the All-Star results so far?
Okay, so I'm going to – this is a bit of a cop-out, maybe – I both love and hate this one, and it's what you just mentioned. It's the Missouri bias that we're seeing early on. You know, in the AL, I think I grew up being so used to seeing Yankees, Red Sox dominate the top of the list. So in that sense, it's kind of refreshing to see five Royals there.
Yeah, I agree. That was on my list too. I think the fact that the Royals were doing so well, not because of the stuffing the ballot, but because of, like, oh, look at the Royals, look at you guys, and continue. I'm sorry.
Well, and then just the negative of that being there are clearly a ton of Royals fans just stuffing the ballot. And I, of course, haven't checked this because I'm terrible. But I heard that there's just a button that you can push where it will nominate every player from a specific team during the voting. I should probably check if that's true. But that just seems like a real easy way for to explain this, basically.
Well, and so one of the things I hate, and I'll just keep it together on this topic, like, Alex Rios is number six among AL outfielders, and he's played seven games. You know, like, and I guess you think was it last year or the year before that Derek Jeter was, like, doing really well and he was, like, not even playing. So I get it. I mean, there's precedence for this, but at some point, I guess it's almost like the idea of doctoring the baseball, like, you know, what we've seen with pitchers lately. It's like we'll let you get away with voting for all your favorite players. Just don't be so egregious about it, and don't vote for Alex Rios. You know, like don't put the pine tar, you know, right there on your wrist where everybody can see it. Don't vote for the guy who's played seven games.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I would say, though, one of the positives, overall, I would say the National League ballot is not that bad. I mean, you look at all the people leading their current positions, and even though there's four Cardinals who would make the game right now, at least three of them are deserving. I personally feel that maybe Buster Posey should be above Yadier Molina, but otherwise, this is not a bad first ballot. Aside from Posey, I think Justin Upton should be higher, but it's really hard for me to argue with all the other choices.
On my love list, I actually have one of the Cardinals on my love list too, and that is Matt Carpenter. I think we've talked about how good he's been on the site before. But I also look at it like this. He has almost twice as many votes as Chris Bryant, and Chris Bryant would be one of the guys who would just sort of, you know, the hype machine would maybe just bring him into a starting spot in the All-Star game. I wouldn't say he deserves it at this point. Not to say that he couldn't deserve it by, you know, the end of June when voting kind of wraps up. But I do appreciate that, you know, the hype machine hasn't just thrust Chris Bryant into number one, and Matt Carpenter, who is deserving, mind you, you know, is number one at third base. So I did like that.
I think this is my final like or love. Bryce Harper leads the voting in the National League.
Oh, I had that one too, man. We're on the same wavelength.
Well, yeah, I mean, you just see the big negative response he gets from fans sometimes, and this is pretty refreshing in my eyes to see him completely leading the way in the National League.
And I thought also for the same reason, but also like with the idea that, and maybe it's been perpetuated by, I don't know, you know, comment section trolls and people on Twitter, and we tend to think that you know, those opinions matter the most, but or I guess those opinions are more representative of people than they actually are when you're like, man, people really hate Bryce Harper. And then you see something like this, and you're like, oh, I guess they don't, you know? I mean,
yeah.
It's just those people that hate Bryce Harper are the loudest. But he's obviously deserving of you know, the position he's in, having the most votes in the NL. So it's good to see that. One thing I hate is, I would say, like, Prince Fielder deserves to be doing a lot better in the voting than he is. I mean, he's not even on the top five for anything in the AL. The first baseman in the top five is Miguel Cabrera, Eric Hosmer, Mark Teixeira, Jose Abreu, Albert Pujols, which, I mean, good players and all, but I mean, Prince Fielder has been doing really, really, really good, especially in May. You know, leads at least the American League in batting average. Does he lead the American League and the National League? I think he might, but
he's been on fire.
Well, okay, D. Gordon's a little bit ahead of him, but you know, leads the American League. He's been really good. I mean, not saying that he deserves to be the starter, but he deserves to be on there. So he's one of my snubs.
Yeah, I would say my final two hates would be snubs as well. So Josh Donaldson, the guy's destroying the ball, and you know, maybe this is somewhat of a recency bias thing because. Since these have been released, he's played really well. You know, they probably released these figures before the last couple games, and Donaldson's been on fire. So he's second in the voting behind Mike Moustakas, and I know Moustakas had a great year, but it's getting hard to ignore what Donaldson's doing in Toronto. So that would be one of them. And then the other is just Michael Brantley deserves to be higher. He's ninth among AL outfielders, and he's tearing the cover off the ball. He can't be that far behind Prince Fielder in batting average in the American League. And he missed some time early with a back injury, but he's just fantastic. He's a phenomenal player, and he deserves to get some recognition for that.
My the other one that I think, you know, the guy who deserves some love, and I think traditionally doesn't get as much love as he deserves just in general, Brandon Crawford. And, you know, I'm in California. I know a whole lot of Giants fans, so, you know, I hear it more probably than anybody, and I still think he's underrated, and I think that, you know, a lot of people probably on the East Coast are like, I don't even know who Brandon Crawford is, I don't even care. But he has the highest WAR of any shortstop in baseball right now, according to Fangraphs. And, I mean, like, anybody, not just the NL, anybody. And he's, like, fifth on the NL list, and, you know, some of that is he's not as big of a star as, like, Troy Tulowitzki or you know, even Starling Castro. Johnny Peralta's number one, but that's sort of a Cardinals thing, I think. You know, and Crawford, obviously, he's in striking distance. It's not one of those things where, you know, somebody has like a million votes like some of these other positions. But, you know, I look at Brandon Crawford, like, hey, here's a guy who's been performing really well. you know, in a position where, you know, he has a realistic shot to maybe make it. And the Giants fans actually are also really good at voting for their All-Stars.
Yes.
In the outfield, you know, Aoki and Pagan are 4 and 5, and I mean, I wouldn't really, you know, count them as like, oh, those guys definitely deserve to be All-Stars. So it's just kind of puzzling to me that Crawford isn't higher, but, you know, maybe we'll see that sort of pick up in the next update.
I agree. I think, is that it? Do we cover all?
Yeah, I got all mine. So if you got all yours, we can move on to our
same here.
Our decidedly non All-Star next topic.
All right. So I feel like we have to talk about the Marlins at this point. A lot of changes over the past couple weeks, starting with the firing of Mike Redman. He was replaced with Dan Jennings. Some weirdness since then. The players skipped a charity event. And there hasn't really been a lot of news about why that happened or whether there was a silent protest of some sort. And then this week, their third base coach got reassigned to outfield instructor after apparently there was confusion about some signs at third base. And so it just seems like the whole situation is getting really weird and it hasn't worked thus far. So is it going to work as we move forward into the season? And I would add to that, what are they going to do if it doesn't work in June or July? Because they've made some pretty desperate moves already.
Yeah, they are a team that sort of feels desperate. I sort of had a glimmer of hope for them when they won, you know, because they lost, like, what was it, Jennings, like, first, like, 5 or 6 games, and then they won finally. And they had, like, that hot tub. They were partying in, like, the bar that has like a hot tub or something in it, like at the stadium. And I'm like, okay, maybe that's what you guys need. You needed a hot tub party, but it hasn't really carried on too much. They've lost 3 in a row again. I just feel like they're a team who, at this point, they've tried, they kind of set things up. You're like, man, the Marlins could do it. And then they've just been kicking themselves in the face ever since. And, you know, some of their players have been doing well. It just seems like their front office people are not capable of coming through with, like, a good strategy and keeping things together.
It just seems to me like there's a lot going on underneath the surface that we're not hearing about. I know yesterday, I think Ken Rosenthal tweeted something about the players being frustrated, and that was kind of the first time I feel like I've seen that publicly expressed since Jennings took over. And I'm not necessarily surprised by that. I mean, I could see how anytime there's a coaching change, I think you have players who are sympathetic to the old coach, but then the fact that this new guy is coming in with zero experience playing the game, you know, maybe you and I don't think that's a big idea, but I feel like that resonates with the players, don't you?
Yeah, and when I saw the thing about them not attending the charity event, that was the first thing I thought of, is like, man, that's like an organized, you know,
right
protest that is meant to send a message, and not necessarily the fans. I think the fans are obviously the victims there, you know, unfortunate victims probably too. It's more to say to management, like, hey, you know, bad word to you. And so that was my first thought, and obviously it sounds like it's your first thought. I just don't see this situation getting any better. You know, I feel like a lot of times when you make a change, it can be something that kind of, you know, spurs the team to get it together. I just haven't got any inclination from anything that's going to work for the Marlins.
Let me tell you what would work for the Marlins. Alex Rodriguez is the manager.
Oh.
No, that was suggested today in a column. It's not anything that is imminent, but he has strong ties to Miami. And I think I said this on the first podcast, but he's a pretty intelligent baseball mind.
You did say that.
What do you? I think, you know, I highly doubt that this will happen. Especially, you just consider A-Rod's contract situation and the stigma surrounding him. I'm more intrigued, I guess. Well, we should keep this about the Marlins, but I'm more intrigued about what A-Rod's career becomes post baseball.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. My first thing, honestly, when I saw that, I was like, oh, Chris is going to talk about how smart he is about baseball, and nobody gives A-Rod credit for being smart about baseball, but I'm like, I just don't understand, like, who cares? And not in a kind of lame kind of like why is this news kind of way. But I mean, like, are we anywhere to the point that we think that A-Rod's going to stop playing baseball, or that the Marlins are going to bring him on as like a player manager? I mean, it's just sort of like this goofy idea, which would be fun for chaos' sake, but A-Rod to be a manager, like, let's let A-Rod just focus on being a DH first, okay? Let's just worry about that. Let's not worry about A-Rod managing anybody.
It seems impossible that he'll get a job managing after his career is done, but after kind of seeing the case laid out, I'm kind of in favor. It seems like he might actually do a pretty good job if given the chance.
I don't think that he couldn't. I mean, he could one day. I mean, you know, Mark McGwire has been a... seems like a valuable coach. I don't know that he's ever going to be a manager. Maybe that's sort of there's that wall there. But I just feel like why are we talking about this? Like, why does it, aside from Buster Olney kind of throwing it out there, and yeah, it's a fun idea, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Now, I have a better kind of managerialist type question is, when is Ruben Amaro going to get fired?
Yeah.
Because
that's a solid question.
The story out of Philly this week where general manager Ruben Amaro Jr. of the Phillies, if you're not sure who I'm talking about, seemingly unprovoked, just kind of went off on the fans, saying, quote, "They don't understand the game. They don't understand the process. There's a process, and they bitch and complain because we don't have a plan. There's a plan in place, and we're sticking with the plan. You know, blah 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 blah." But it's never a good look for the GM of the team to come out in an interview unprovoked and just kind of stick it to the fans. Like, it was the context of the interview was, you know, Jim Salisbury from CSN Philly was talking to Amaro about just sort of, you know, some of the top prospects and some of the trade stuff. Seemed like a general kind of what's going on with the Philly situation. And I Ruben, are you stupid? And not in a, you know, stupid to think that way. It's like stupid to say that, stupid to put that out. People already don't like you. Don't give them another reason to hate you.
Agreed. And I feel like, let me drop some truth bombs here.
Uh-oh.
Most fans are idiots, probably. And most GMs probably feel this way about a large portion of the fan base. But, like you said, never a good idea to make those feelings public. And obviously he had to come out and apologize for making them. I almost side with Amaro a little bit here in that he is responsible for putting the team in this awful situation. At the same time, I'm not sure what he's supposed to do tomorrow that is going to turn this thing around. I mean, the Phillies clearly need a long-term rebuild. They have some pieces they can trade, you know, mostly Cole Hamels, possibly Jonathan Papelbon. Amaro has every right to wait until the best deal comes along at this point. And so if that's not going to happen in May, maybe it'll happen in June or July. So in that sense, I kind of get where he's coming from. I mean, I think they do have a plan. Maybe it's not the best plan, but they clearly do have a plan.
I think
that was part of his frustration.
I feel like a part of a general manager's job is to have a little bit of tact and to know, you know, that you need to keep seeing certain things close. You need to know how to kind of like play the media to your advantage. You need to be able to keep, you know, your cool in situations. So if you're reacting like this to like some, you know, very easy sort of interview type stuff, how are you reacting in trade situations, you know, when you're going up against, you know, some of the more savvy GMs in the league and trying to pull off a deal? Like, if you can't handle a basic interview without devolving into, like, going after the fans, then how are you going to establish that plan and then make a good trade? There's a truth bomb for you, Chris. There's a truth bomb.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, I don't really have anything else on that, so unless you do, I feel like we can move on.
Fire him. Let's go. Let's move on to the next thing.
All right, so this was the tease from earlier. One of the hotter teams in baseball, the Texas Rangers, surprisingly.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the A's, man.
No, Texas Rangers have been playing really well on the heels of Prince Fielder's recent hot streak, as you kind of mentioned during the All-Star voting, and they also have Josh Hamilton back. So the team is really close to 500 at this point. They're hovering around that that record. And after just such a rough start and losing Yu Darvish at the beginning of the season, are you buying this? Can this continue, not just for them, but also, you know, with Fielder's kind of resurgence and then just with Hamilton coming back? I mean, see, everything's coming up Rangers right now. Is that going to last?
I don't know that. I'm not necessarily buying the Rangers as a contender. I could buy the Rangers as like a surprise 500 team. And we covered this last week when we talked about the Astros. You know, sort of being in that range in the AL West, though, you know, could be a lot more beneficial than in a different division, because, you know, the Angels are still sort of just hovering around 500. The Astros have kind of pulled away. You know, they've already won 30 games. So, I think there's a little bit more opportunity for them in that division, you know, where being 500, I mean, could, you know, put them in second or third place. But I'm not buying the overall, like, oh, here comes the Rangers with not a ton of pitching, you know, being viable into September. And Prince Fielder, you know, I'm happy to see him doing well, but I don't think that he is, you know, enough to necessarily carry them. And unless Josh Hamilton comes back and is just like, you know, MVP type Josh Hamilton, he's been a little bit rusty so far, but you know, you can't hold that against him. I mean, it took Chris Bryant a while to get it together too. So, I don't think in the long term that the Rangers are going to be, you know, a team that we're, you know, talking about in September. And I don't know about Hamilton. I mean, I think, you know, their fates are kind of interwove, whatever that word is. And I think that, you know, I think with Hamilton, you're really just kind of hoping that he, you know, it does okay. I mean, I think anything beyond like sort of okay and average is you know, great for him.
It's not going to happen, man. There's no pitching here. I mean, Giovanni Gallardo is not what he used to be, and there's just too much for them to overcome in that rotation. Colby Lewis, I just don't trust anybody there. I mean, there's nobody I want starting the first playoff game in a series.
No.
You know, Gallardo used to be ace caliber. He's something much different now. But
if they can avoid last place, I think, you know, you could be like, oh, it's pretty good.
I agree. And you know, we've mentioned the AL West. The Mariners are really starting to come on. So it seems like if anyone's going to make this serious run at the Astros, it's going to be them, which probably isn't a surprise because a lot of people picked them at the beginning of the year to win this division.
Yeah. So we told you at the top of the show, we have a special guest joining us today. And his team actually is another team that's doing better than a lot of people thought. That's Tampa Bay Rays. They're hovering around the top of the AL East, and then they have been for a while. Talking about Evan Longoria, folks, he has his own shoe coming out through New Balance, which we're going to talk to him about, and a little bit about the Rays. So let's roll our interview with Evan Longoria. All right, this is the Big League Stew Podcast, the Stew Pod. It's Mike Oz here. We have a special guest today, Evan Longoria, who's going to talk to us about a little bit of baseball, but first and foremost, sneakers, which I think is kind of cool. Evan has a new shoe coming out through New Balance, and what I think is interesting about it is it's not actually a cleat. When we think of baseball players, we think of, you know, putting out cleats and shoes for the game, but he actually has a sneaker coming out, and I think that's, I mean, I can't think of many players who have done that except maybe Ken Griffey Jr. Evan, first though, I've heard about how you're a sneakerhead, so I kind of want to start there and give a little bit of context. Tell us a little bit about your sneaker collection.
Man, I don't really have any specific type of shoe that I collect or anything that I actually collect in general. I just love shoes. I love sneakers, and I think the main thing that needs to be said though is that I wear all my shoes, so I don't have any, you know, boxes that I just like keep up in the closet. You know, that I kind of just like pay homage to. I have a couple of pairs that I guess are the ones that I wear the least, and they're a couple of pairs of Oregon Jordans, a pair of three and a pair of five Oregon Duck Jordans that I got from one of our owners, actually, who knew somebody high up, and I got lucky and got those. But other than those, I wear all of them. I try to force the New Balance people to send me all the collaborations that that they do with all of their independent stores and designers and stuff. And so whatever I can get my hands on, I wear.
You got to take advantage of those connections, right? But you don't have like the big shoe shrine. Like, I know that we see a lot of these. Like, I think last week it was the Colin Kaepernick picture of, you know, all this. So no big shoe shrine. You just kind of have them like in the rotation, as people would say.
Yeah, I mean, I have actually, it's not a huge closet, but I could probably fit, I don't know, 20 or 30 pairs of shoes in my closet, and it's full, and it's, but it's all shoes that I wear, and you know, mostly, like I said, collaborations by New Balance. I love Common Projects, and just like 3s and 11s and 13 Jordans are probably my favorite shoes to wear.
So I remember being in fourth grade, and the shoe I think the first shoe I ever wanted was the Air Jordan 4, specifically like the military blue, which I never got until I was, you know, like 27 and gainfully employed and can actually go buy them for my own self, which was actually kind of nice. Like I actually went in line and, you know, 6 a.m. and stood in line and got them, and I felt like I had kind of made it in life or something. But so I wanted to ask you, like, growing up, what was the first shoe that you were like, oh man, I have to have that?
You know, the first one that I remember, there's actually two. I played baseball, basketball, football growing up, so I always, and basketball, of course, always had like the coolest shoes. You know, football and baseball, you just wear cleats, so it was like, you know, there wasn't any, like, you couldn't really differentiate too much. So for basketball, I remember wanting or getting actually the Fila Grant Hills when they came out, with like the patent leather, like blue triangle around the outside. And then I had the Air Pennies, the original Air Pennies when they came out. And those are the two pairs that I really remember the most, wanting. You know, I could never get the Jordans. When I was a kid, I think I had the Jordan 8s with like the cross strap. And that was like the only pair of Jordans that I ever got. And I was a little bit older, but, they always like sold out before I could get there. So it was the Air Pennies and the Grant Hill Fila that were probably the two most memorable.
Well, let's talk about New Balance, obviously, cause that's who you're working with. Like, I saw your shoes. I thought they were really nice. I liked a lot of the different design touches. Like, it kind of had, like, the cement print on the bottom, like, the little bit of what looked like kind of denim on there, on the front. What were some of the influences, like, for you as you were kind of sitting down to do this? Like, what shoes were in your mind as, like, I want to do something like this or I want to do something like that?
The biggest influence for me was probably... just thinking about what I wear mostly on a daily basis. So I wanted the shoe to be something that was comfortable and that was versatile. And those two things kind of were the underlying factors for where we ended up going with the design of the shoe. The denim in the shoe kind of speaks to my love of jeans and denim in general, and how, you know, I think everybody pretty much wears jeans at least once a week if you don't work in an office, and you know, jeans are just part of my lifestyle, and so that kind of that element cloaks me, and just like suede is my favorite type of leather, so most of the shoe is suede on the outside, and then there's like a sheepskin lining on the inside that's super soft, and we just wanted it to be really, really comfortable and use awesome, materials, and it came out great.
Hey, Evan, it's Chris here. I'm wondering what the actual process was like when you started designing the sneakers. Sounds like you kind of had some ideas going in, but what's the entire process kind of like?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I was like super excited. Like you said, I haven't seen anybody really had the opportunity, if anybody that's in my shoes had the opportunity to design an actual lifestyle shoe. And so that was, I was honored that New Balance gave me the opportunity to do that. and to work with Kai, who is just awesome at what he does and does collaborations with everybody that New Balance works with. So, I had an idea of what kind of where I wanted to go with the shoe, and it ended up like in the complete opposite direction of where I initially thought I was going to go. And I had, in the beginning, I kind of had these color pattern ideas and, you know, different crazy things that I wanted to do. And ultimately, you know, talking with Kai and just getting the feedback from him, we ended up going with the blackout design and the denim and everything, just because he kind of coaxed that out of me in a good way. You know, he kind of told me, well, if you want the shoe to speak to you and you want your fans and the people who eventually buy the shoe to know that it is about you, then this is where you need to go. So where we ended up was definitely more my style.
Sure. I mean, have you ever done anything similar to this before, or is this kind of your first time? I don't know if I want to say getting into like fashion, but in a way, sure. I mean, shoes are an accessory. So is this the first time you've done anything like this?
Yeah, I mean, the only other time that I've done something like this is just like online, you know, going on newbalance.com and designing a shoe, you know, but the amount that you can do in real, I don't want to say real life, but when you're actually designing a shoe, like from the ground up, working with a designer and being able to use all the resources that New Balance has, it's much different and much more overwhelming than just going on newbalance.com and being able to, kind of, you know, go through the process of customizing, you know, a 574 or a 996 or whatever shoe, you're allowed to customize on the site. So there's, you know, you only have a select few options versus basically infinite possibilities with your own design.
Evan, we kind of talked about how, you know, there aren't a lot of baseball players that have had sneakers or lifestyle shoes. And I mean, in my mind, and it may only be Griffey, I don't know, maybe I missed somebody, but on the kind of like serious note, like, why do you think that is? Why do you think baseball players kind of don't have those opportunities as much as, is it just because you think of a baseball player and you think of spikes and cleats and stuff?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And I also think that there's really not too many baseball players that are interested in it. You know, I think there's some guys, obviously there's plenty of guys out there that are very recognizable and have great sponsorship behind them and have the notoriety and would probably, if they pushed for it or if it was something that they were interested in, would have the opportunity to do something like this. But I just don't think it's that big of a deal. And when I initially signed with New Balance, that was kind of one of the things that I had mentioned to them, was that I love, you know, shoe style. I love the cleat style, and I think that's something that baseball really lacks. And I think we're starting to see more and more guys are kind of, I don't want to say pushing the limits, but, you know, there's some cooler, bolder designs out there with on-field shoes that it's starting to get a little bit better. And you know, we talk about just trying to market the shoes to the younger generation, and to do that, I mean, you have to kind of stay up with what's current, you know, on lifestyle shoes, and so it's gotten better.
Obviously, we know a lot of athletes are into shoes, and in baseball, it seems like Jeremy Guthrie is probably like the most famous kind of sneaker guy. But who have you played with, or who you interact with that you know, or you know, around baseball, either teammates or you know people you've played against that are really into sneakers?
Bobby Wilson on my team is like a huge sneakerhead. I mean, he's a Jordan guy, but I mean, he's a guy that has like, he has like 60 pairs or something like that. And he's got them in boxes and, you know, he really collects them. And he's probably the one guy that I've been around that is actually, you know, really, really into shoes. Like, he knows all the release dates and everything. So, he's probably the biggest sneakerhead that I've been around.
It's good to have somebody like that sort of in your camp, so they can tell you what's up. Is every does everybody in the team prepare?
We're gonna try. I think that it's been talked about, and I think that's my hope.
Cool.
So we'll see. So
Evan, the you guys are off to a really nice start this year. I'm wondering though, there's been a lot of injuries as far as you know with pitching rotation, and then obviously Desmond Jennings is hurt right now.
Right.
I'm assuming a lot of guys look up to you as a leader on the team. You've been there a long time, and you're obviously established. How do you get the other players on the team to kind of look past those injuries? Because obviously, you've had a lot of them, and it can be a negative thing, but you guys are obviously playing well through it right now.
Right. Yeah, I think the guys have really, it hasn't affected us too much. I mean, I think because we came into spring training, we left spring training and started the season with so many guys banged up that it wasn't something that was really weighing on us. You know, it wasn't like we went, a week into the season, then all of a sudden we lost 9 guys and we were like, you know, what do we do now? We've pretty much played all of spring training without a good number of those guys. And so coming into the season, we really, I think, just maintained that confidence that we had coming out of spring training. And so it's almost like as we add, of course, we had a couple of other key losses. I mean, losing Smiley and Cobb for probably the whole year and then having Desmond go down. Those are things that happened a little bit later on. But we've gotten a couple guys back now, and I think that confidence is starting to build, knowing that we have some other pieces that are going to be returning as well.
Yeah, I also wanted to ask about the pitching staff. So much was kind of made of David Price leaving, and everyone likes to talk about leadership on the staff, and it seems like while you guys have a couple guys who have been around for a long time, it's still kind of hard for me, I guess, to think of like Chris Archer as this big veteran guy or like Jake Odorizzi in the same role. I'm wondering, we've kind of seen their improvements on the field. I'm wondering kind of who stepped up off the field or how important it is for the pitching staff in general to have that type of leadership.
Chris Archer has been probably the leader of the staff, I would call it, although he's only a couple of years in. He has been probably the anchor or the backbone of the team. And he has that leadership mentality. He has that ability to be a guy that the staff can look to and kind of lean on when things get tough. And so it's been a little bit different just because the staff is so young and we've had so many guys come in and out already. But I think we're going to be fine. I mean, obviously those guys are throwing the ball really well and they have a good idea of what it takes to win at the big league level. And so it's been fun to watch that development.
And then I had one more baseball question for you. I wanted to ask about your new manager, Kevin Cash. You've got to see him now through spring training and through the regular season. I know people are going to make a big deal about it if you guys continue to play well, about his management and leadership. I'm wondering what his major strengths have been early on through this stretch here.
He's just a really good communicator. I think that's the best way to describe him is he really just keeps everybody in the loop from top to bottom as far as what his plans are on a daily and sometimes even more so a couple days in advance, just trying to give guys the best chance to prepare to get themselves ready to play or whatever their role is going to be for that day. So from the beginning, he's just been really open that way and just kind of helped our team along just because of a lot of the uncertainty that we've had and the pitching rotation changes and days where we've had to kind of piggyback starters and use the whole bullpen and kind of platoon position players. He's just been really good at communicating.
So, Evan, I have you on my fantasy team, and I'm not going to be the guy that asks you or that complains about my fantasy team or anything. But I was curious. I think it's like a funny thing when people do that, because I think it's kind of absurd. But I'm curious, what is the like craziest and what is the best story you have about somebody coming up to you and or tweeting you or whatever and being like, hey, my fantasy team, you're on it, blah, 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 blah. Like, what are your best stories?
Yeah. And I usually what I tell people who tell me that, I have you on my fantasy team and you suck or something like that. And it's like, well, why am I on your fantasy team? Usually I just tell them, why, just trade me then. Go ahead and trade me, because I get it a lot in person. But people will say it behind my back, like at a game or something. And then if I turn around, they turn around too and look the other way or look at somebody else. So, just own up to your fantasy woes if I'm on your team. And if you don't like me, just trade me. But that's usually what I get is, you're bringing my fantasy team down or I need to steal more bases. That's what I get. I need to steal more bases and I don't understand why. I haven't sold bases since I was a rookie or something like that, so I don't know why people keep drafting me thinking I'm going to steal 50 bases, but whatever.
Hey, work on it, man. Now that you got those shoes,
yeah, right.
Now that you got those New Balance, the new sneakers, maybe you can get those stolen bases.
I guess I need to, right?
Hey, Evan, thanks for hanging out with us, man. It was great to talk to you about the shoe, obviously, and baseball, and everybody should go check them out. We're back on the Stew Pod and getting ready to wind things down. Very happy once again to have Evan Longoria talking with us. And Chris, of course, was very happy to talk about sneakers because it's his favorite pastime. Right, Chris?
Of course.
He loves sneakers. I like sneakers, but Chris likes baseball. So it was a good mix. Got an interesting email the other day that I shared with you, and I figured it'd be good podcast fodder. We get emails a lot. Usually they're not nice. Usually they're just every once in a while it's someone asking a question. This one I felt like actually was a good discussion topic. So I'm going to throw it at you, Chris, and you can tell me what you think, and we can bounce off some stuff. It came from Steve, who I think the premise of him writing was talking about Didi Gregorius and how he hasn't really been all that effective at the plate for the Yankees, and he was kind of curious about the use of defensive players, who have offensive limitations. So here's his question. Generally speaking, is the baseball talent so watered down that other teams are willing to put up with terrible RBIs, home runs, and batting averages in favor of fielding attributes? Crowds more likely favor good hitting over good fielding, in my opinion. That is not to say I don't appreciate a good fielding play. So what do you think is going on this season with batting averages? Is it due to superior pitching, or are the general managers of most teams simply over the hill?
All right, so I love this question. I think there are a ton of things going into this premise. So I kind of have three major things. I guess I'll just kind of throw them out there, and then hopefully, I'm kind of hoping I steal all your points so that you have nothing to talk about. But
let's see if you can do it.
Okay, so when Moneyball came out, that was kind of, the beginning of the statistical revolution. There was no focus on defense. It was all these softball-style hitters. You had your Matt Stairs, those types of guys. Those were the undervalued guys because they were getting on base. It's definitely shifted since then. There's a much higher focus on fielding because that, for a while, is what was being undervalued on the market. You could get a good fielder and you could take advantage of that for cheap. So I feel like that's why we're seeing guys like Didi Gregorius get run out there, even though they're not as accomplished as hitters. On top of that, I think the point about relief pitching is certainly a valid point. You have a lot of guys now who are averaging 95 miles an hour. Feel like the average fastball speed has gone up the last couple seasons. You're also getting more specialized bullpens, so you're getting lefty-righty matchups, loogies, roogies, all those guys coming in with specifically one job, and they do it very well, and so that's going to limit batting averages. And then the shift. We have to talk about that here because that's played such a big role in limiting players' batting averages, mostly left-handers, but if, you know, some teams have adopted some right-handed shifts, I think just, you know, those are kind of the three main things that came to my head. I mean, that's why we're seeing low batting averages and poor offense.
And I think you hit on some really good ones. I did want to show that I feel like we should say that Didi Gregorius is hitting 217 so far this year, which he hit 252 in 2013, but he hit 226 last season. So, I mean, it's been kind of a steady decline, but I don't think it's, you know, a surprising thing that he's hitting what he is. And I did also look up the league-wide batting average right now, which is 251. And surprisingly, it's actually the same as it was last year. So I wouldn't say this is a thing that has necessarily, you know, changed this season. It's kind of steadily gone down from 269 in 2006, but you know, it's kind of fluctuated. Even back in 1992, it was 256. It was 254 in 1988. So, you know, it kind of fluctuates. I wouldn't say it's, you know, a huge dramatic thing. I think you hit on most of the points, but I would just say we're also in an era where, as is widely accepted, there's a lot of really good pitching. And, you know, you brought in some of the specific examples, and I think the defense shifts obviously are part of that. But, you know, it's not a secret that pitchers at this point are, you know, better than hitters. And, you know, they've been talking about ways to sort of increase production, you know, and excitement in the game. And, you know, I think that's all kind of interwoven, especially when you talk about Steve's point that, you know, people would rather see good hitting over good fielding. And I think that's true. I mean, you look at the NFL, you know, they put a premium on offense and everybody thinks football is so great. And but I don't know, you know, I always like to watch, I think defense, you know, especially in our world, you know, one home run is sort of generally, you know, not that different from the next. Whereas, you know, I think really good defense, really good play, a shortstop or an outfield catch, to me is far more interesting, you know, to watch than necessarily a home run. I mean, you know, some Bryce Harper, some Giancarlo Stanton, some, I guess, Chris Bryant home runs excluded. You know, I feel like defense is very good to watch. So I just kind of wanted to quibble with that point. But good explanation, Chris.
Where would you put a dominant pitching performance in there? Because, I mean, that's probably my favorite thing to watch. I'd prefer to see Felix Hernandez go out and toss a complete game shutout over a game with, you know, six home runs or, you know, one or two great defensive plays. Mainly because in a game with six home runs, you're probably getting awful pitching performances. And so in that sense, that's not necessarily fun to watch, depending on who's on the mound, you know?
Yeah, and I appreciate pitching. I appreciate the pitching performance, too. I think that's a very good point. But I do understand, though, what Steve is saying, and that most people probably don't. I would say that,
yeah,
you know, we're probably a little different than your average baseball fan who, you know, if they go to a game, you know, a big part of the experience is wanting to see a home run, wanting to eat a hot dog, and, you know, wanting to drink a beer or whatever and pay too much for all that stuff. So I think that, you know, on an experience level, there is something about that people like, more so than, you know, some of the pitching and defense stuff. For your casual fan, I mean, for your, you know, hardcore baseball person who watches baseball every day, then of course, you know, they're going to have a greater appreciation for, you know, a great pitching performance.
And I will say this to quickly refute Steve's point a little bit. You know, shortstop is the one spot where it's the most valuable to kind of sacrifice that offense for a strong defender, because aside from maybe catcher, that's the most important spot on the field defensively. So if you're going to stick a guy in there who's going to hit 200 but give you great fielding, that's probably the best spot to do it at. Even though I understand his frustration with Gregorius at the plate.
Those are my truth bombs. All right, Chris. Well, I think we've made it through another podcast. So I hope all you people out there listening enjoy it. Tell your friends. Give us a link. Give us a shout out. Review or whatever you do with podcasts these days. We will be up on iTunes soon if we are not already, which I'm working on sort of as we record this. So watch out for that, and come back each week for an all-new installment of the Stew Pod, where me and Chris have fun jabbering about baseball and other stuff. You can say goodbye to the people, Chris? Say goodbye. They deserve a goodbye.
All right. Hey, it's been fun. Love talking to you guys, even though it's a one-way conversation. But hey, you can comment. You can comment. Let us know what you want to see here. Also, send in more questions. The reader question this week was excellent.
Truth bombs. All right, peace out, everybody. When we glide the world, what we telling them? Still got it, baby boy. Within the loudest crowds, what we yell at them? Still got it, baby boy. Walk amongst the people, what they are saying? Still got it, baby boy. Those that thought they were equal, they demise saying? Still got it, baby boy.